Continuing on in our series, and like I told you last week, this will be my last time to be up here preaching the disciple series. Next week, Levi is going to end things, and the week after, my good friend Joel is going to come and do a little bonus of the disciple series. I'm very excited to hear from both of them, but going to continue on today. We are, like I said, in Mark chapter 9. We're going to start in verse 14, and I want to set up the scene and kind of bring us up to speed from where we were last week. And I want you again to catch the scene at the beginning of Mark chapter 9, that Jesus is on the mountain of transfiguration. He has displayed his glory to his closest disciples, and he is now at this point where we're going to start reading, coming down off of this mountain of transfiguration, again, as this pinnacle of his earthly glory, the moment when these three disciples get to see him for who he truly is. And then we get this story starting in Mark chapter 9, verse 14. When they, Jesus and the three disciples, returned to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd surrounding them, and some teachers of religious law were arguing with them. When the crowd saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with awe, and they ran to greet him. What is all this arguing about? And you'll notice that nobody answers this question, but a father jumps into the fray here. One of the men in the crowd spoke up and said, "Teacher, I brought my son so you could heal him. He is possessed by an evil spirit that won't let him talk. And whenever the spirit seizes him, it throws him violently to the ground. And then he foams at the mouth and he grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And so I asked your disciples to cast out the evil spirit, but they couldn't do it." And Jesus said to them, "You faithless people, how long must I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." Now I have a picture up here of a piece and a work of art, right in that next picture there, buddy, is Raphael's, not the Ninja Turtle, that's not what I'm talking about this morning, Raphael the painter, the great Renaissance painter. His last painting that he did before he died was called The Transfiguration. And you'll see up there it depicts everything about this story of the Transfiguration. But what I find particularly interesting is we have Jesus there and Moses and Elijah, the three disciples that are down on the ground casting their eyes away from the glow of Jesus. But what you have down here below is a story that we just read. And the way that Raphael puts both of these pictures and these moments together is pretty amazing. You'll see down here this chaos that is ensuing, the arguing of the disciples and the scribes and the boy that is possessed by this demon. Jesus walks, again, from his moment of glory here on this earth, he walks right into a firestorm. The other nine disciples are being heckled and taunted by a group of scribes and religious leaders. The disciples, and we find out what the argument really was about, was the disciples had attempted an exorcism while Jesus was up on the mountain. And they had done this before. I don't want you to miss that. It's not that the disciples couldn't do it and didn't have the power to do it. Remember when Jesus sends the 12 disciples out earlier in Mark, and he sends them out with the power to cast out demons? So they could do it, but they failed spectacularly. And for that, and in this moment that we just read, they are being roasted. And you can almost imagine the scribe saying, there was a phrase and there was a saying during Jesus' time, and Jewish scholars would say this: the messenger is as the man. That was the phrase that they had. And what they meant by that was you could tell the kind of people, or you could tell the kind of leader by the people who followed them. And at this point, you can almost hear the scribes and religious leaders saying that. The messengers, you disciples, are as the man himself, in this case, Jesus. And they're looking at these scribes, or they're looking at these disciples, they're like, "You guys are phonies. And so is your leader." Their inability to do anything in this situation reflected very poorly on Jesus. As someone dissecting the opening part of this story has said, "What a shock it is to see this after the glory of the Transfiguration, of Jesus moving from light to darkness, from worship to cursing, and most tragic of all, it was a descent from power to helplessness." And you understand what the Transfiguration really encapsulates, don't you? It really encapsulates Jesus' incarnation to this world. a God who would descend to this earth, would lower himself on this earth to rescue the people. And that this took place, this moment that we just read about, takes place just after the transfiguration is no mistake. I've been telling you that for weeks as we've been working through Mark. Mark moves at a very fast pace at the beginning, and it seems like he's all over the place, but there is a purpose to why he places things in the way that he does. There's a story that's being told here, starting at verse 14. And I want you to notice some contrast between the two moments. Transfiguration, demon-possessed boy at the bottom of the mountain. The transfiguration, it says, takes place on a high mountain. This episode that we just read with the boy held captive by a spirit happens in the valley, in the lowest place. This boy and his father are in the lowest place they could be in their life. In the transfiguration, there was glory. In the boy, there was only suffering and torture and misery. In the transfiguration, God himself dominates the scene that very moment. And upon coming down the mountain into the valley, Satan seeks to horn his way in. He wants to be the star of the show. In the transfiguration, the Father is pleased. Remember, he says that this is my son. I'm well pleased. Listen to him. In the instant directly following it, an earthly father is beside himself. And as someone has said, just as Moses came down from God's presence on Mount Sinai, Adam was just reading out of Exodus, it's a moment in Mount Sinai, Moses comes and he spends 40 days and 40 nights with God himself, and he comes down to faithless people of Israel, so also Jesus comes down from being in God's presence to find faithless people waiting for him. And that's where the story continues, starting at verse 20. They brought the boy to Jesus. But when the evil spirit saw Jesus, it threw the child into a violent convulsion, and he fell to the ground, writhing and foaming at the mouth. How long has this been happening? Jesus asked the boy's father. And he replied, since he was a little boy. The spirit often throws him into the fire or into the water, trying to kill him. Have mercy on us and help us. What are those words there? If you can. Oh, wait a minute, hold on for just a minute. This is the Jesus who has been going all around Galilee, and he's been performing miracle after miracle. He has calmed the sea and the storm in the sea, done the most amazing things anybody can imagine, and this guy has the gall to say, if you can, Jesus, if you have that ability, Jesus, if you have that power, Jesus. Jesus says, what do you mean, if I can? Anything is possible if a person believes. The father cried instantly. And again, I told the Bible study group this morning, this is one of the most honest, authentic, vulnerable, transparent, real, true prayers that I know of in Scripture. It's just a simple, honest plea. I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief. Anybody in here this morning that kind of feels like that sometimes in their life? God, I want to believe. I do believe you, God. But clear up and cure my unbelief. When Jesus saw the crowd of onlookers was growing, he rebuked the evil spirit. Listen, you spirit that makes this boy unable to hear and speak, he said. I command you to come out of this child and never enter him again. Then in a last-ditch attempt and effort, the spirit screamed and threw the boy into another violent convulsion and left him. The boy appeared to be dead, and a murmur ran through the crowd as the people said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand, as he often did through the book of Mark, and he helped him to his feet, and he stood up. And afterward, when Jesus was alone in the house with his disciples, they asked him, why couldn't we cast out that evil spirit? And this is such a key line here in verse 29. Jesus replied, this kind can be cast out only by prayer. And Jesus, in this moment of chaos and everything going on, you faithless people, you faithless generation, how long do I have to put up with this? Like, it's very rare in Scripture that Jesus gets exasperated. This is one of those rare moments. It's like the ultimate, like he's throwing his hands up in the air and it's just like, oh, I can't do this. You faithless people. And guys, here's what we understand, right? As we read this story, the biggest violators of this are his disciples. For more than 2 years, and by this time we're reading this story, the guys have been with Jesus for like almost 3 years. The disciples had largely walked by sight. What they could see, what they could touch, what they could taste, what they could hear. Peter, James, and John, guys, just before this had seen the glory of God in the Transfiguration. They had all been in the presence of Jesus and they had seen amazing things. John would later write in the very beginning of his gospel, one of the greatest lines there at the beginning of it, John chapter 1, verse 14, John writing, again, one of the guys who saw this on the Mount of Transfiguration, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son. And although the disciples operated largely in Jesus' ministry by sight, there was coming a time when they would quickly have to learn to live by faith. And that's why I'm convinced that this moment right here is a teaching moment for the disciples. It's a teaching moment for us as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7 says this about very simply this idea of seeing and sight and faith. We live, we only live by believing in faith and not by seeing. And that's what Jesus is trying to teach his disciples. I believe that's what's being spoken to us in this moment in Mark chapter 9. And while the crowd is made up of mostly unbelieving individuals and the Father shows a faith that is weak and incomplete, the thrust of Jesus' phrase, oh, and that in some translations he uses just this word, oh. It's a very rare word and that he uses at all. Oh, unbelieving generation, it was mainly aimed at the disciples and their failure to believe Jesus. In fact, what we get here in this moment is Jesus is pained by their unbelief. I mean, it was borderline offensive to Jesus. It was hurtful to Jesus in this moment that the guys had been following him around for 3 years still didn't get it. They still didn't have faith. And after all the time they had spent with Jesus, all that they had seen, their small and tiny faith was inexcusable. Jesus' exasperation, his expression of complaint that he has here, is the loneliness and anguish of one authentic believer in a world which expresses only unbelief. Do you understand? Do you imagine how lonely it must have been for Jesus? To walk around, to know the Father's will, to live in the Father's will, to minister in the Father's will, and everybody else around, to some degree or another, didn't believe a word that he said. That's loneliness. That's why he cries out, oh, faithless people. This lament that he has doesn't express that he's just, you know, we would be tempted to say, if it was us, we get to this point 6 months from our death and the disciples still don't get it. We're just like, I'm done. I'm walking away. Like that could have been the moment that Jesus said, I'm off the scene. You guys have fun. Like I've been trying to teach you. He doesn't want to get rid of the disciples, despite their dullness, but he realizes how little time he has to soften their hearts and make them see and understand what he is trying to teach them. That's why he is exasperated here. Jesus was frustrated because the disciples, he had commissioned them earlier. Remember, he says, go out and to preach the good news. You have authority over demons to drive them out. And they failed in this moment. This father had brought his son and said, disciples, help me. Get rid of this. They had been successful. But after a week, it says that 6 days later, and it says that they're up there and these disciples are with Jesus, Peter, James, and John, for about a week. They come back to the other disciples and they had become totally weak, W-E-A-K. They can't do anything. They're powerless. And the problem here, we look at this, we're like, that's really, really odd. They could do it before, but why can't they do it now? And the problem wasn't that they lacked effort. They really wanted to. But it was an absence of believing faith. And I think what really happens here is that they had faith in themselves. They failed because they misdirected their faith and they put it on the wrong object. And guys, don't we often do the very same thing in our life? We start looking around and we start looking at all kinds of things that we can put our faith in, and we take it off of the one person who it belongs on, Jesus. We get distracted by all of these things. Someone has said about the disciples, they believed in the process, they believed in themselves personally, but they did not rest in the power and the person of Jesus Christ. And I want you to know this at this point, and I've got the point up here. Braden, find it back there for me, buddy. Guy, previous success, anything that you have ever been successful at in your life before, is not a guarantee of future victory if God's not in it. Can I say that again? It doesn't matter how many times you've shown up in a situation and be like, well, I can do this because I've done it before. I can win this because I've won this before. If God is not in it, you are going to fail and fail massively. And that's what happens here in Mark chapter 9. Guys, faith is never self-reliant. You see what he says here at the very end, and this is the key verse I told you. This kind can come out by nothing but prayer. I don't know if it was this reading plan that we just finished up or the one before it, but they had a moment in it when they said this, and I wanted to use this line because it fits really well here. Guys, in life, we need to acknowledge our limitations. And we don't do that to sit there and be like, well, I'm just so bad at this. Can't do anything right. We acknowledge our limitations. This reading plan also said that we lean on God's declarations, His promises. God says, I'm capable of anything. Jesus says here, if I can, I can most certainly do anything. Guys, we need to lessen our pride, and we need to increase our dependence on the only one who can. And the whole miracle, as I've said, is about developing the disciples and us by pointing a finger at the uselessness of self-reliance. Guys, with us and only us in the mix, everything seems impossible. Everything with us is suspect at best. But with God, all things are possible. Or as he says here in Mark chapter 9, everything is possible for the one who believes. Guys, prayer is an act of putting all things in someone else's control, namely God's in this case. And I'm convinced, because I know this in my life, we cannot handle it if we are not in control. How many of you cannot get into a car and not be the driver? That's me. I want to be the driver at all times. I might be able to handle the passenger seat, but do not put me in the back seat or I'm a basket case. That's how we operate in life. Here's the newsflash of life, guys. I want you to hear this morning very clearly. We aren't in control of much in our life. In fact, I would take a step further and say, I don't know if we're really in control of anything in our life. And prayerlessness, guys, the disciples' inability and their overlooking prayer in this situation, our prayerlessness in our own life is an indication of our selfishness, of our own self-reliance. Maybe you often think to yourself, gee, you know, I don't really pray much. And perhaps that is because you think too much of yourself and you think too little of the God who absolutely can and will do anything when we turn our focus to Him and ask for what He wants. And the question that I thought that I have this morning is, have we become so good in our lives at God things that we've stopped looking to and relying on God? That we become so professional in our Christianity that we no longer feel like we need God's help in anything. Again, I got this handled. I've been here before. I've done this. You remember the Old Testament story of Samson, don't you? Samson was so confident in his own strength and his own good looks. You remember the story, Samson and Delilah, and they're sitting there and the guys conspire and they say, Delilah, find out where Samson's strength comes from. And she begs him and pleads, tell me what it is. And he tells her something that's really not true. And she does it, and she puts him in a really precarious position. And then every single time, for several times in a row, she would always say, Samson, they're here. And Samson would like rip his, he'd like rise up to the occasion. He would, you know, be the hero of the story. But he finally tells her the source of his power, doesn't he? It's in my hair. So she chops off all that hair, and he thinks, just like before, every single time, I'm going to rely on my strength, and I'm going to get out of this. And he finds that last time his power has been sapped. I think it's a larger picture and a larger condemnation against Samson, not because he lost his hair, but because he lost his reliance and his faith in God. If we become so casual in approaching God that we fail to see the line where we run out and where God steps in, and again, let me give you a really big hint, that's not a terribly far line in front of us. We run out really, really quick. God gives us struggles and he gives us challenges to drive us to him and develop what's lacking inside of us. I'm convinced here in Mark 9, that's what happens in the story of the disciples. They flub up. They fail in a major way. God's not surprised by it. He said, I wanted to have you guys fail and see you fail in this moment so that you'd learn to turn to me. It's a very interesting line. He says, this kind can be cast out only by prayer. What in your life right now is this kind? That is a problem, that is a struggle, that is a frustration that you just can't get right. You can't get past unless you just pass it along to God. Guys, we fight so much in our life to try to take care of issues that we are not able to handle. This kind won't go away with enough smarts and with enough cleverness, with enough ingenuity, with enough diligence. It will only be conquered with a faith that says, I can't, but God, you can. And I think in life, lack of prayer and lack of a prayer life is either a sign of one of two things. One, you have very few problems in your life, which I really highly doubt that anybody in here would say, yeah, you know, you're right, Ryan. That's why I don't need to pray at all, because I don't have problems in my life. Because I can assure you that no matter how much we think we have a big faith in ourselves, that we can handle any situation, life often shows us that our small faith is a large source of our problems and our frustrations. Ryan, why do I struggle? Why do I struggle with this? Why can't I get past this? Can't get I over this? Perhaps it's because you have too much faith in you, and you don't have enough faith in the one who needs to have our faith. Guys, faith is focused on Jesus, squarely on Jesus, when everything else around us seems to be in chaos. It's the opposite of what's happening in the story. At the beginning of the story in Mark chapter 9, the disciples are arguing with the scribes are arguing back, the crowds are in a frenzy, this father is beside himself because his son is demon-possessed. Guys, when things close are focused on, everything in the periphery becomes blurry. You understand that, right? Do this real quick with me. Can you just put your finger up? There you go. Okay, now look past your finger, and what does your finger look like? Okay, two, or it looks blurry, doesn't it? So I'm looking out there, my finger's blurry. Now try this and look at your finger. What does everything around you become? Blurry. It's the way sight, it's the way vision works. I'm convinced this is the way that faith works. When you look and you put your focus squarely on Jesus as the center of everything, everything else around you becomes a blur. It's not that it doesn't exist, because it's still there, but it becomes a blur. Your focus is right on what it needs to be on. It's like having a camera, Like we go in the studio every week and we film the rap. And Levi always says this, and this is going to sound really funky, by the way. He says, "Look into my eyes." And I'm like, when he first said that, I was like, "This is really weird. What's he doing?" But what he's doing is he's trying to get a focus on me so that I'm not blurry and I'm not distracting in that. Guys, we need to, as you would use a camera, we need to choose our focus. We need to change the lens on our camera so that it's focused on what it needs to be focused on, the object that it needs to be focused on. In Mark 9, the crowds are all about Jesus fixing their problems or about getting their Jesus fixed. Wow us again, Jesus. Do something amazing, Jesus. But they're not fixed on Jesus. The people of that generation are filled with thoughts about Jesus, but they're filled with disbelief and a lack of faith. And here's the thing, though, guys, that I understand, and I think you understand as well in your life. I don't think that we beat people up. I don't think we beat ourselves up because, like, oh, gee, I didn't have faith there. If only I would have had a little bit more faith, things would have been different. Guys, here's the deal. Here's what I think we see all over Scripture, and especially here in Mark chapter 9. Sometimes, guys, faith is small. It's so minuscule, sometimes we can't even detect it. And the issue is never if God can or can't. It's whether we believe that He can. What follows after this man's prayer, and this is what really gets me about this story. We're thinking to ourselves, the guy says, "I do believe, but help me where I don't believe, Jesus." And you would think in that moment, that's where like everything just changes in the story. The boy is made well, and everybody, "Yay, Jesus, you did it again." What actually happens in the story? "I do believe, help me where I don't believe." What happens next? Things actually get worse, don't they? Why does it seem sometimes when we are struggling most in our faith, it often becomes even more of a struggle with added problems and added pressures? And I think this is what happens so often in life. The moment that we want to give up is the moment that we need to push through because God is trying to lead us to real faith, real, lasting, big faith. How do we know in this story that this father has real faith? Because on the surface, we look at it and we say, it doesn't look like he really has a lot of faith. I mean, it's shaky, very, very shaky. I think we know that this father has a measure of faith because he is there. He has brought his son to Jesus. He has at least an inkling that Jesus can do something in this dire situation. He could have been anywhere else. He could have taken his boy to anybody else. He could have tried any other solution, but where does he go? To Jesus. Brings his boy to Jesus. And guys, guess what? Like I said, faith is sometimes small. It is sometimes a wobbly, decrepit, slats-missing bridge. I've got a picture here of you remember in the Temple of Doom, that bridge that spans all the way, and you're looking like, I would never walk across that thing. You find that picture, Braden? Go ahead and put it up. You remember that bridge, don't you? And he's being, like, on both sides. He's being, like, cornered and penned in. That's sometimes what faith feels like, doesn't it? Like a bridge, you're like, who in their right mind would cross this bridge? That's our faith sometimes. But as we cross that bridge, we see the faithfulness of God and the might of God. We begin to step more assuredly, even in unsure situations. Only the bridge of faith, guys, connects us to God's unlimited resources and His power and connects it with our neediness and our brokenness. You realize that, don't you? At any time in life that we show up before God, all we ever show up with in our life is just neediness and brokenness. And God sits over here and He says, "Well, guess what? I have all the resources at my disposal to be able to take care of this." That only ever happens if we connect it with the bridge of faith. Big, real faith. Kent Hughes, an author and a pastor, says, "A faith which declares publicly, but at the same time recognizes its weaknesses and pleads for help, is a real faith." See, we would often say, like, oh, if you have any sort of doubt at all, if there's any sort of shakiness in your faith, then you don't have real faith. No. Actually, what Scripture says is quite the opposite sometimes. That by being very honest in our unfaith, in our disbelief, and the parts where it's incomplete and whole, he says that's where it's actually the most real. Desire, guys, and this father has a whole lot of desire. Desire is an evidence of faith, even in doubt and in shakiness. Faith is never about subject or substance, but it is about the object, Jesus himself, that we focus on. I want you to think of it this way. Imagine you are up north this summer, let's say like way up north in Minnesota, dead of winter, and you see a lake that looks like it's covered with ice. And you decide, I'm going to kind of creep out on this ice here, and I'm going to see if it's sound, if the ice is good. Guys, it doesn't matter if you get out there by lunging headfirst onto the ice. It doesn't matter if you get out there by tiptoeing to the center of the ice. The real test of everything is the soundness of the ice. You see that, don't you? It doesn't really matter about your faith in the ice. It's the soundness of the ice. It doesn't matter if you have all the faith in the world that ice is wonderful if it's only like a half inch thick. It's not going to hold you. It doesn't matter how strong our faith is if it's set on the wrong thing, on the wrong object. Because the strength of our faith, the source of our success and triumph, can never be put on autopilot, cruise control. It's not enough to depend on our reservoir of faith that we've built up over time. We must constantly return to the well that is Jesus to get more of him, to get more faith, to get more of the power that we so desperately need in our lives. Because I just said, didn't I? Because we only ever show up needy and broken. I want you to think about this way. I read this line this week and it blew my mind. Do you realize that sitting where you are right now, in faith, you have more power at your disposal today than the disciples did with Jesus and before Acts 2? You understand that, don't you? You have more power than the disciples did before the coming of the Holy Spirit. Just think about that. Think about that. Not just now, but think about that as you leave today and let that inform your activity and let that expand your faith. More power than the disciples. You see, guys, the disciples' problem was not their intensity of their conviction or the strength of their passion or the steadfastness of their dedication. The problem wasn't how they believed. Again, this father's faith is really shaky and deformed, but it's who they failed to believe in. The disciples had a very deficient faith, and they had a very insufficient prayer life. And maybe God speaks to us more clearly and uses us better in the times when we see our inadequacies. A man by the name of Henry Nouwen once said, prayer is a way of becoming empty and useless in the presence of God and proclaiming our basic belief that all, every single thing that we have, every victory that we experience, every triumph that we have in life is all because of God's grace. And nothing is simply the result of hard work. Let go of us and grab a hold of more of God. But where the disciples lacked in their faith and in their prayer, they more than made up for in their pride. I want to read the next part of this story, starting in verse 33. Jesus has just told the disciples for the second time now, I am going to die. I'm going to be betrayed. And in, like, listen to this, guys. Jesus. Guys, I'm second time now. I know you're not going to like to hear this, but I'm going to have to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to have to die. Directly after that, verse 33, after they arrived in Capernaum and settled in a house, Jesus asked the disciples, what were you discussing out on the road? Silence. They did not answer because they had been arguing about which of them was the greatest. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, guys. I'm going to die. It's going to be a really bad death. It's going to be really horrible. Hey, guys. Which one of us do you think is going to be the greatest? Who's going to sit on Jesus' right hand? Ugh. He sat down and he called the 12 disciples over to him and said, whoever wants to be first must take the last place and be the servant of everyone else. Then he put a little child among them, and taking the child in his arms, he said to them, anyone who welcomes a little child like this on my behalf welcomes me, and anyone who welcomes me welcomes not only me, but also the Father who sent me. Again, the disciples had just heard, second time Jesus has said this, I'm going to die. It was not the time for an argument. It certainly was not the time for an argument about which one of them was going to be the top dog. Who knows how this conversation went, but we know from other accounts that they often thought about who was going to have a claim on top dog status. In fact, if you go just a chapter over, Mark chapter 10, verses 35 and 45, you see James and John coming to Jesus. Actually, not James and John, their mom comes. That's even worse, guys. When mom has to get involved, that ain't good. You aren't cool then. Mom gets involved and she's like, Jesus, my sons, James, John, you know them. Can they sit on your right and left when the kingdom comes? They were constantly arguing about this. We know that Jesus was already at his wit's end. Oh, you faithless people. So we can only imagine what this conversation about being the greatest does to him. If it had been any of us leading this ragtag bunch of guys, we would have just walked away long before this. But Jesus sticks with them, and he keeps teaching them, and he keeps forming them, because the mission is greater than their silliness. Again, they have been with Jesus for nearly 3 years. He's months from his own gruesome death, facing ultimate humiliation, and these chuckleheads are arguing about which one of them are the best. The night before Jesus dies in the upper room, do you know what they're arguing about again? Which one of us is the greatest? They were arguing about that, and they were so caught up in themselves and set on themselves that no one would stoop to be a servant and wash the other's feet. And so Jesus, the Son of God himself, gets down and he washes the feet of these prideful, arrogant creatures. We do this all the time in our life, don't we, guys? We argue all the time about who is the greatest. Who's the greatest singer? Who's the greatest guitar player? Jimmy Page. We argue about the greatest band, Led Zeppelin. And we argue about the greatest team. We argue about the greatest athlete of all time, but it seems it's not good enough for us, because then we also trump that and we say, we want to determine who is the best of the best. There's a phrase out there today, and especially in the sports world, called, who is the GOAT? The greatest of all time. That's the argument we constantly have in our lives. And the debate also becomes very personal at certain points. We begin to measure ourselves against other people, how we shape up against those around us. We turn it into mini and we turn it into major competitions. Guys, none of us in here this morning lacks self-esteem. Every one of us is consumed with us to one degree or the other. Every one of us is born with an aspiration for significance. We want our lives to count. We don't want to fail to achieve the goals that we pursue in life. The last thing we want to do is to come in last. We're not satisfied with mediocrity. We dream of glory and of winning and of reaching the pinnacle of success, of getting to the top, of attaining greatness, of being the best. And guys, while that is admirable on a lot of levels, it also turns very sour very quickly. That does for these guys here in Matthew and Mark chapter 9. Jesus turns everything back around in this moment with these guys to its intended purpose. If you want to live, you have to die. If you want to save your life, you have to lose your life. If you want to be great, you have to suffer. And the way to greatness is the way of service. Guys, you and I must be the greatest servants that we can be. Nothing is below us. No one is too low for us. Jesus doesn't reject greatness, but he redefines greatness. You guys want to be great? Do you want to be great? Be great in the things that matter. to God, not in your own little tiny mind and heart. Guys, we're constantly being bombarded in our world today with a cultural perspective that deifies winning. If you're not winning, you're the loser. And if you're the loser, nobody wants anything to do with you. Being number one is American, and it's even thought by many people to be Christian. But to always want to be served is less than Christian. And the disciples missed that initially, as we do in our own day. Jim Collins wrote a book a number of years ago called Good to Great, and he looked at businesses who were just really model businesses. And he comes to a point in his book, and he talks about, he sat down with all of these CEOs and all these bigwigs, and he goes, I can always tell you, and without fail it worked out this way, the CEOs that were the most successful were the people who didn't talk about themselves. They always put the focus on someone else, on how that person was doing their job well. And when somebody did try to turn it back and say, but you have been a great leader for this company, they just sort of deflected it. He said, in every single case, I could predict what that company was going to be. And it proved itself out with people who were humble, who served other people. And to illustrate what humility looks like here in Mark 9, Jesus gives the disciples a living parable. And the power of this parable lies in this. He brings this child and he puts this child on his lap. And in the Aramaic, and that's the language that Jesus spoke, in the Aramaic, the word for child and the word for servant are the same word. And what Jesus is saying as he puts this child on his knee is that the disciples must receive children and other disciples and other people that nobody wants to have anything to do with open arms and with love and affection. There's no air of precedence. Nobody is better than anybody else. You see, here's how it worked in the Greco-Roman culture. Children were insignificant. They were nobodies. And honestly, for most people, they were just a nuisance. Many children in the Greco-Roman culture, and sometimes even in the Jewish culture, were abandoned, or worse, they were killed in the act of infanticide. Most families in the ancient history, in the ancient world, were one-child families. And you nearly always wanted a boy, and if you had multiple children, you wanted them all to be boys because girls just cost too much. There was a dowry to be paid later. You didn't want to mess with that. That's a bother. That's an inconvenience. Children did not have a utilitarian purpose at all. They weren't viewed as being good for much of anything. And we look at this story and we think to ourselves, well, guess what? If we want to be humble in life and we want to be truly great in life, do you know what we need to do? We need to be like children. That's not what this story says. Children are not the model of humility. How we treat children and how we treat people who everybody else treats as insignificant and low, that's the model of humility. That when everybody else says that person, nobody associates with them. That we associate with them. That when we find what we deem or what other people deem to be the lowest person in the room, we get lower than that. You remember the story in Scripture where they're talking and they say, hey, if you show up at a party, don't try to vie and be the head of the table. Just go sit at the kid table. Go sit at the little card table over there. And then when the guest of the house elevates you and brings you to the head of the table, you'll be honored. But if you go the other way around and you try to get for yourself what's not yours, you'll be humiliated and said, just go sit at the kiddie table. That's humiliation. What Jesus is really trying to communicate here, guys, and I believe he's communicating it from verse 14 all the way through where we are, is what can you do in your life to get low? Are you so high and mighty in your life? Are you so up here that you have no time to deal with everything else around here? What do you need to do in your life to get low? The path to greatness and the journey to lowness starts by doing for those who can't do anything in return for you. That we stand to gain nothing by helping and serving them. Author Tony Merida says it this way, the gospel, guys, this is the great news of the gospel. It frees us from our addiction to ourselves. Before the gospel, we're not interested in serving as we are in being served. We're not as interested in giving as we are in receiving. We're not as interested in pursuing God's ways as in getting our own way. We're not as interested in being least as we are in being the greatest. And we're pretty certain that the way to greatness is not by obedience that leads to death, but by being last and servant to all, having others do what we can't, pursuing a life of serious suffering. But that's exactly what Jesus is saying as he lays out the road to true greatness. You want to be great? You guys in here want to be really great? You guys watching want to be really great? Three things he says in this section. I want to just highlight them very quick. Obedience to the will of God marks a truly great disciple. It shows up in real faith. Also, what he says is service to others marks the truly great disciple. David Brainerd, I came across this quote and it's become my new favorite quote. He says, "It is sweet to be nothing and less than nothing that Christ may be all in all." I love that idea. And then lastly, and I'm going to read a few more verses here to close out. Allegiance to Christ alone marks the truly great disciple. Verse 38. John said to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone using your name to cast out demons, but we told him to stop because he wasn't in our group." Oh, gosh. And we laugh and we cry, but it's us too. "Don't stop him," Jesus said. "No person who performs a miracle in my name will soon be able to speak, 'You've loved me.' Anyone who is not against us is for us. If anyone gives you even a cup of water because you belong to the Messiah, I tell you the truth, that person will surely be rewarded." Isn't it very interesting? The disciples get really upset with a guy who is accomplishing what they couldn't accomplish just a few verses earlier. This guy's casting out demons, doing amazing things. And the disciples are like, whoa, wait. He's not with us. He's not in the group. Yeah, guys, you weren't able to do that, remember? But he's able to do it, so maybe that's why you're mad. Guys, allegiance to Christ will lead us to applaud and to celebrate those on God's team, even if they are different from us. It's not about our little club or our little gathering, but the wider story that is being written in the life of the church across the state, across this country, across the world. It's not about us alone. John, the same guy who with his brother James, you remember this story, they're in Samaria and the Samaritans are really rough with the disciples and Jesus, and they're like, "Jesus, should we just call fire down and just burn this town up and burn these people up?" You got like Jesus like, "Yeah, guys, that's exactly what we should do. I totally have taught you to do exactly that." John is the same one who pipes up here in Mark chapter 9 and confesses to being less than kind to someone who is not like them. And what I take from this is John says, Jesus, this guy is not part of Team Jesus. Better yet, Jesus, this guy is not part of Team Disciples. The real issue here, guys, in Mark 9 at this point, what we just read, is I believe that this man was able to do what the disciples were unable to do. And admit it, that is a source of a lot of our jealousy today. When it comes to church factions and church fights, we get upset because someone thought to do something before we did. Or they did it better than we did. And that irks us. Guys, this is an unhealthy and an unhumble way for a disciple to behave. One of the most important marks of a disciple is that we can cheer on other Christians. Good for you. Glory to God. It wasn't me. I don't know if I completely believe with you. You don't look like us. You don't. But God is getting the glory, and we cheer that on. Guys, this is disciple 101 that Jesus is doing here. Pastor Sinclair Ferguson says, in the last analysis of a disciple-like attitude, it is more important that the servants of God are devoted to Christ than that they are one of us. What is Jesus teaching here? I just told the Bible study group this morning, Mark 8, 9, and 10 are known as the disciples' discourse. Teaching of the disciples. What is Jesus trying to teach his boys here, and what is he trying to say to us? I wrap it all up by saying this. Guys, we need to keep focused. To have real faith, you need to lose yourself. You need to become God-dependent. But that doesn't just stop there. Hey, if you have just enough faith, everything's good. Keep focused. And the second one is this. Get low. To go high in life, to go high in the kingdom of God especially, you have to get low. I asked a question again that I asked just a little bit ago. Where in your life is God calling you to get low? There's something God has called you to. There's someone God has called you to. Something he's asked you to do. And you've just refused because you think, that's below me. Some area of your life where you become way too reliant on you. Reading plan we're going to be doing this week is called The End of Me. And the end of you is where Jesus starts. I pray this morning that for all of us, we would find exactly where we end and where Jesus begins. Would you pray with me? Lord, that's a hard prayer to say. It's a hard, hard thing for us to ask, but I pray for myself. I pray that others in here would ask the very same thing that I just said. That we would find where we end, where all of our cleverness, all of our smarts, all of our hard work ends, because we realize that it doesn't amount to much of anything if we're not focused on you. And the Lord, as we end, as we give up control and we place our faith, we put it squarely on you, the only one who is